This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Our next guest is Glenn Greenwald, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Greenwald, along with The Guardian and The Washington Post, broke a series of stories about the National Security Agency and mass worldwide surveillance. And they did so through a treasure trove of documents provided by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
In his new book, Greenwald tells the story of his first clandestine contacts and meetings with Snowden, and he reveals a disturbing new set of NSA programs that describe an information collection apparatus of virtually unimaginable scale. In the book's epigraph, Greenwald quotes Senator Frank Church, who in 1975 said, "Such is the capability to monitor everything, there would be no place to hide." And the book is called No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. Glenn Greenwald is in town for a discussion tonight with Noam Chomsky at the First Parish Church in Cambridge, but he joins us now in the studio. Glenn Greenwald, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So listeners, if you've got a question for Glenn Greenwald, you can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Glenn, I just wonder if we could start by getting a little bit into the story about how you ended up first meeting Edward Snowden, because in the book you describe this sort of long back and forth beginning in December of 2012, when the man who you'd eventually discover is Edward Snowden first makes contact with you and asks that you basically communicate with him through encryption, which you kind of didn't get around to doing for a while. But finally, before you meet him in person, you have this online chat with him. And I'm wondering what he told you at that online chat that made you utterly convinced that he was the real deal and actually had some information worth sharing.
I wouldn't say I was utterly convinced that he was the real deal until I actually got to Hong Kong and met with him and began speaking with him. But I certainly had a strong indication that he was reliable prior to my arrival there, in part because of those lengthy discussions that he and I were having on the internet prior to that time. He was insistent right from the very first day that we spoke that he wanted to identify himself as the source and to come forward and explain to the world why he did what he did, which of course is extraordinarily unusual for a source who typically wants to remain anonymous when right. they're giving you top secret documents. But he had a very compelling reason, which is he felt like what he was doing was the right thing and he didn't want to hide. He wanted to stand up and explain why he did it. And so he kept asking me to come to Hong Kong. And I finally told him that before I did, I wanted to see some evidence that he had what he said he had. He then sent me roughly 24 documents, which he emphasized were the very, very tip of the iceberg. And those were explosive and amazing. And that's how I knew it was worth making the trip for.
Well, a couple things. One is that in that first, in one of those early sort of online interactions, not only did he tell you that eventually he was going to want to tell the world who he was, a risk in and of itself, but he also told you that he wants to spark a debate, a worldwide debate about privacy, internet freedom, and the dangers of the surveillance state, and that he wasn't afraid of what was going to happen to him. Had other people who wanted to like leak information to you, had they been that sort of outwardly, some might say brazen, others might say courageous?
I've never seen somebody who was devoted to leaking any kind of classified information, let alone the magnitude of what he was telling me he wanted to leak, do anything other than plan how to be anonymous, because it means an almost certain prison term if you get caught. And that was the most stunning thing to me from the start, was why would this person, I didn't know anything about him at the time, including his name, when we were just talking online, but I wanted to understand why somebody like that would be willing to do something that they know would send them to prison for the rest of their lives. Yeah. And he was very clear about the fact that he believed this was such a grave injustice that he was willing to pay essentially any price in order to know in his own mind that he stood up and confronted it.
So you eventually enlist the help of The Guardian, who you'd been a columnist for up until that time. And The Guardian does send you and a couple other people who are key to the story to Hong Kong. And as I was reading this part of the book, I imagined you sort of in the hushed darkness of a 14-hour airplane trip from New York to Hong Kong. And at that time, you had actually you had a lot more documents to look at while you're on the airplane. And there was one about you describe reading about the NSA's Boundless Informant Program, which basically quantifies the agency's daily information gathering activities. And there's a map that showed how much one unit of the NSA was able to collect. And later on, we find out that, for example, in February 2013, the NSA's this one unit collected more than 3 billion pieces of communication data from U.S. comm systems alone. I mean, it's a staggering, staggering number. At that time, before you'd even met Snowden and you're there in the darkness of the airplane, did you look around and think, nobody else knows this?
That was, you know, definitely one of the most surreal experiences of my life, because I've been writing about surveillance for many years. I wrote a book about the NSA back in 2006, and I had been a person who believed and had been saying that I thought this was an out-of-control agency, that there was indiscriminate and wild amounts of surveillance taking place. But to see them in action and to see it quantified with such exactitude, I mean, it's 3 billion each month just from the U.S. systems by one unit, but it's 150 billion emails and calls around the world on any given day that they can sometimes collect. And to see that degree of just extreme behavior that takes place in complete secrecy and then be reading about it at a top secret level on an airplane with all of it on my laptop, and then seeing that Snowden hadn't leaked 2 dozen documents or 100 documents, but many tens of thousands, that really made me understand the magnitude of what the story was going to be.
Did you doubt the veracity of the documents that you were looking at that time, since it was one of the first times you'd been able to see them?
Well, when somebody tells you that they want to give you top secret information and then does so and you don't know who they are, you have to be very on guard over the fact that it could be a fraud. It could be somebody vindictively trying to induce you to publish documents that turn out not to be real. Your career is on the line, essentially. But when I saw how many documents there were, the tens of thousands, and I began looking through them, it would have been almost impossible for someone to fabricate that number. Just the sheer quantity of alone convinced me that this was likely real.
Yeah. So you finally meet Snowden in Hong Kong. There's a little more cloak and dagger before you get to sit down with him face to face. What was that first meeting like? What did he strike you as? Like, what kind of person were you sitting across from?
Well, the meeting that I had with him when I first actually met with him was really disorienting, because I had been assuming, for a variety of reasons, that this was somebody who was very senior in the U.S. government, probably somebody in their 60s or 70s.
And he was sitting across from a 29-year-old at the time.
Right. He shows up and he's 29, but he looks at least 5 years younger. Everyone has seen him on video, but he was wearing sort of jeans and a T-shirt. He's a bit scrawny. He hadn't left his hotel room for several weeks because he was concerned about what would happen if he did. So he was very pale and kind of awkward. You know, I think we've all had the experience where we talk to somebody or meet somebody online and have a mental picture of what they're like, and then it turns out when we meet them that it's wildly different, and that was certainly the case here. So I was disoriented. I was also a bit more suspicious at this point, because I couldn't understand how somebody that age could have developed such a sophisticated insight into this agency and into spycraft generally, and also how they got access to that number of documents. And so my skepticism was increased, and my first goal when we got back to his hotel room was to sit him down for as many hours as I needed to. It turned out to be 5 or 6, and just to very aggressively interrogate him without letting him go to the bathroom or without giving him a glass of water, just to put him under, you know, the most severe stress test I could to see whether his story would hold up. And I could instantly see, which I already knew, that he was very, very intelligent, but more importantly, he never hesitated in answering any of my questions. There was no calculation going on in terms of what he would try and tell me. It was all very organic and very fluent. And after several hours, I just intuitively knew that what he was telling me was the truth and that I could rely on him as a source.
You know, in the videos that you eventually release through The Guardian, he does seem eerily calm.
That was, you know, by far the most amazing thing in retrospect of the whole experience, which was, you know, our working assumption when we were in Hong Kong was that as a result of what he had done, that he was going to end up in U.S. custody sooner rather than later and probably spend the rest of his life in an American prison, which is sort of renowned for being quite oppressive, the American penal state. And it's a really horrible thing to happen to you that destroys your life if that happens. And despite that, every single night at the same time, he would go to bed. He would have no trouble sleeping. He'd wake up looking very refreshed, in contrast to myself and Laura, who were basket cases and barely sleeping. And he just had had an equanimity and a tranquility to him that was completely disparate to the situation he was in. And ultimately, I realized that that calmness came from this conviction that he had, that what he was doing was so morally and ethically right, and he was so at peace with what he was doing that it brought this tranquility to him. And to this day, I've never seen him express any anxiety or remorse or nervousness about the choice that he made.
So you mentioned Laura, who is Laura Poitras. Did I say her name?
Yeah, Laura Poitras.
Poitras, the documentary filmmaker who Edward Stone had also reached out to, and you knew
and collaborated with her
in much of your reporting. Well, let's get into a little bit more about, you know, what you and The Guardian and The Washington Post discovered with this treasure trove of documents that Snowden handed over to you. I mean, there's a PowerPoint that you include in your book, No Place to Hide, that outlines the NSA's new collection posture, as it calls it. And it has a circular diagram with several boxes around it. And those boxes are collect it all, process it all, exploit it all, partner it all, sniff it all, and then know it all. So I'm wondering, from what you know that these documents reveal, are there any limits to what the NSA can access, or are there any spots around the globe that are beyond its reach?
Virtually none. I mean, the institutional mandate of the NSA, in their own words, is captured by the phrases that you just read from their own document, which they described as their own collection posture. And this, to me, goes to the nub of the debate that we've been having, which is, for the past 11 months, the NSA and Obama officials and their defenders have been insisting that we need not worry about this massive amount of data they're collecting, because this is a very targeted, discriminating system, and they're only interested in monitoring the communications of terrorists or other people posing a national security threat. That's what they say in public. But in private, when they think that nobody would ever hear them and they talk amongst themselves, what they say about what they're actually doing is fundamentally different. They are an agency that exists to collect all forms of electronic communication by and between human beings in the world, which is another way of saying that their goal as an agency, as an institution, is to eliminate privacy in the digital age worldwide. And whatever you think about Edward Snowden or the reporting we've done or anything else, if the U.S. government is going to do something that profoundly consequential, if we have any hope of thinking we live in a democracy, that at least has to be open and known to the citizenry so that we can debate whether or not we want our government to do that.
Listeners, I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald. He's a journalist, an author, a lawyer, and Pulitzer Prize winner. His new book is No Place to Hide: Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance state. Glenn, based on what you just said, I'm wondering what your response is to one of the primary sort of defenses that comes out of the national security establishment and also a lot of observers of these revelations that you brought forth regarding the NSA, and that is, collect it all means something, but it also means that these vast quantities of data in and of itself are a problem for the NSA because they can't really analyze or search or do something, you know, meaningful and constructive with it when you have 197 billion pieces of data, you know, coming at you every month. So therefore, maybe there's no need to worry.
Well, first of all, it's a really odd argument for defenders of the NSA to make, because it's so clearly at odds with their other principal defense, which is that the reason we do this is to be able to keep you safe from terrorist plots. Because if you're collecting 197 billion emails and telephone calls in a month, it becomes impossibly difficult to find the person who's talking about and plotting to attack the Boston Marathon or trying to blow up a plane over Detroit on Christmas Day. And if you look at what the 9/11 Commission said, they concluded that the U.S. government had in its possession all of the clues that it needed to have detected the 9/11 plot, but they had so much in their possession that they were incapable of knowing what they had. So the more that gets collected, the more difficult it is to fulfill the objective that they claim they've constructed the system in order to fulfill. But the other thing that I think is really important to note is that in addition to collecting all this information, they have developed very, very potent tools to be able to manage and search it. And one of the programs that led Edward Snowden to come forward is a program called X-Keyscore, which I report on extensively in the book.
And that's the one that allows the NSA to track actually real-time keystrokes that people are typing on their computers.
Right. I mean, what you can do with X-Keyscore, and part of what I publish is the training manuals that they give to the analysts, is you can literally go to a page, and it's really simple, and it says enter the email you want to search, and you enter the person's email. You can do a date range or not, and then you hit a pull-down menu where you just click on what's called a justification. You just click, I think this person might be a terrorist, I think they're an agent of a foreign power, and then you hit submit. And without any supervisory examination, that database will then search all of those billions of emails that the NSA has collected and return to your monitor on your desk all of the emails that the person has sent or received that's in that database. And then on an ongoing basis, we'll send you that email each time they send or receive a new one. So you basically have real-time surveillance of their email account. That's what Edward Snowden meant when he said in that first interview, sitting at my desk as an analyst, I could wiretap anyone, including the president, if I had a specific email account. That is a really menacing system. So yes, of course they can't and don't try to read every email they collect, but they certainly have all the tools they need to search for what they want.
But of course the NSA has pointed to that specific statement that Edward Snowden made and said he was exaggerating.
Well, one of the problems the NSA has had and still has is that they actually have no idea what Edward Snowden took and then gave to us, which in and of itself should be disturbing, right? Their other defense is, oh, don't worry, we have this really rigorous, tightly controlled system that prevents abuse, and yet here was somebody sitting right under their noses collecting huge amounts of documents, and they had no idea that he was doing it, and to date, they still haven't figured it out. So oftentimes, especially in the beginning, what they would do is they would make claims such as, Edward Snowden is lying when he says he could have sat at his desk and eavesdropped anybody, including the president, not knowing that we had in our possession the evidence that we were going to then publish that proved that they were lying. And that was certainly the case here.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you could spend a minute or two talking about another one of the programs that you discuss in the book, No Place to Hide. And that's about the NSA's program of intercepting American-made routers, servers, network hardware, essentially. And then they physically intercept these devices, install sort of backdoor devices, rewrap the packages with factory seals, and send them on their way to the foreign clients that bought them from the original hardware company.
Right. And what is most amazing about that is that for many years, the U.S. government has been accusing the Chinese of doing exactly that and have been urging people never to buy Chinese technological products like routers, servers, and switches on the grounds that the Chinese government is almost certainly invading those products and they come with backdoors already installed. Well, as it turns out, there's no evidence that the Chinese do it. I wouldn't be surprised if they did. I have never seen evidence that they do. But there is obvious, clear evidence in the form of these NSA documents that the NSA does exactly that. They literally physically remove the packages from the mail. And in fact, one of the newsletters that they circulated internally where they boast about their success in this shows a photograph of them taking a Cisco package that has been sent by that company to a user who has bought their product and putting it on a table at a secure secret location, opening it up and doing exactly what you said.
Let me just jump in here. Is this being done, do we know at all, with the knowledge or cooperation of these original American hardware manufacturers?
We know for certain that all kinds of tech companies, including Cisco, cooperate extensively with the NSA because there's a document in the book that describes what the NSA calls our 80 corporate partnerships, and Cisco is listed as one of them. We don't have any evidence at all about whether Cisco is aware that their products are being intercepted this way or whether their collaborators are the unwitting victim. Cisco has claimed once in response to my book that they didn't know, they profess concern about anything that would undermine the integrity of their products. So it's unclear. They certainly deny knowledge, but what is clear is that the NSA is doing this.
So I'm curious, Glenn, I mean, with the revelation after revelation that you've been reporting for a year now, more than a year, a lot of people might say, yes, the vast security apparatus is disturbing. There are ethical questions, there are policy questions, there are moral questions. But can you point to actual examples of Americans that have been harmed by the NSA's surveillance programs?
So let me say a few things about that. First of all, I think one of the things that happens in American political life is that we tend to object to certain programs when the party that we disagree with most is in power because we find those programs threatening only then and then sort of are willing to acquiesce to them or even accept them when the party we like is in power because we trust that the leaders of that party to operate this program. That's a really destructive way to think because inevitably the parties switch and whichever party is in power now will go out of power and the other one will come in. And if you endorse a particular system on the grounds that I don't think George Bush or Barack Obama is abusing this system, that shouldn't get you very far because the next president Jeb Bush or Chris Christie or whomever might treat it very differently. But there actually has been reporting about the sort of types of political abuse. We have a document in the book where the NSA has identified six Muslim radicals in their eyes who they say are not part of a terrorist group and not plotting terrorist attacks. And they have monitored their communications online, collected sexually explicit chats that they've had, tracked their visits to pornographic websites, and talk about the capacity to use that information to destroy their reputation and undermine their efficacy as a messenger. There's documents about how they've tracked the visitors to the WikiLeaks website to try and find out who's doing that, members of the group Anonymous. And the other thing I would say is there's a lot more reporting to be done on exactly that question, namely who is being targeted in the United States as the NSA's targets. And I think that will inform that question even further.
Well, then there's also the issue of the NSA's surveillance programs and their potential or alleged use regarding foreign countries, and including allies. I mean, there has been quite a bit of outcry over this, and President Obama has promised greater limits on spying aimed at allies and our partners. But at the same time, I was reading a quotation from Caitlin Hayden, one of the NSA spokespeople, and she was quoted as saying that while our intelligence agencies will continue gathering information about the intentions of governments in the same way that the intelligence services of every other nation do, we will not apologize because our service may be more effective. I mean, so should we be surprised that at least in this regard, foreign intelligence, as the NSA, is using all the tools that is at its disposal?
You know, I think that the idea that everyone is doing it and we're just a little bit better is so severely misleading, because I don't think anybody objects to the notion that the NSA is going to spy on members of Al-Qaeda or other designated terrorist organizations like every other country would. Nor do I think it's all that surprising or even disturbing that they spy on the leaders of other countries, because that kind of state-on-state spying has been going on for a long time. What is really the heart of this controversy is that they spy indiscriminately on everyone, entire populations of hundreds of millions of people, like they did in Brazil, like they have in India, like they have in countries all over the world. It is a system of ubiquitous, suspicionless surveillance. And there isn't anybody else on the planet trying to turn the internet into a collect-it-all system where all forms of communication are stored. And the reason we do it and they don't isn't because we're just kind of smarter. It's because we devote $75 billion a year to turning the internet into this wasteland of spying, and nobody else is doing that.
Well, Glenn, if I may, I do want to spend a minute talking about the fact that in your book you really you pull no punches when it comes to your criticism of what you call the establishment media and its role in all of this, because you really call media organizations out for example, for consulting with the government about disclosing secret information. But I also note, I mean, we talked about a little earlier how you first turned to The Guardian right from the beginning before going to Hong Kong and meeting with Edward Snowden. The Washington Post was also involved. And even in the introduction to your book, you write that just a couple months before you began blogging back in 2001, it was the New York Times that first reported that the Bush administration had ordered the NSA to eavesdrop on Americans without a warrant. So that, too, is also a side of the establishment media, as you call it, which is more in line with sort of the truth-telling aspect of your personal, you know, drive here.
You know, I think it's very hard to talk about any institution in absolute terms. And so even the media institutions that I criticize most harshly, like the Times and the Post, have great journalists working in them who do great journalism. And I acknowledge that all the time. But let's look at that story that you referenced, the New York Times 2005 NSA story, because that to me really illustrates the point most powerfully. The reporters who broke that story, Jim Risen and Eric Lichtblau, actually discovered that the Bush administration was eavesdropping on Americans without warrants required by law in mid-2004, and they wanted to go and report the story then. And the New York Times editor went to the Bush administration and advised the Bush administration that they intended to publish this. And George Bush personally summoned Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, and Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher, to the Oval Office and told them, you cannot publish this story. To do so will damage national security. It was an absurd claim, the idea that if people knew that they were spying without warrants instead of with warrants, that would damage national Security, but the New York Times editor and publisher got intimidated and told their reporters that they could not publish this story. And they sat on that story for 15 months, including through George Bush's election. So they let George Bush get reelected without telling their readers that he was doing this. And only once Jim Risen got so frustrated that he went and wrote his own book where he broke the story, did the New York Times get worried that they were going to get scooped, and then finally allowed him to publish the story and then reveled in their courage as they won the Pulitzer Prize for it. So that's the kind of subservience to government interests that I'm talking about.
And we're running down on time here, but there's one more thing I want to ask you, because I want to return to something very briefly that Edward Snowden told you in one of your earliest online chats with him, even before you'd met him. And he told you that he only has one fear in doing all of this, that people will see these documents and shrug, that they'll say, we assume this was happening and don't care, that the only thing he's worried about is that he's going to do all this in his life for nothing. Should he still be worried about that? Because there has been a hue and cry over it, but no real substantial change in the practices of the U.S. surveillance state, as you call it.
I think that he believes that the debate that has been galvanized has been more intense and more sustained and more consequential than what we expected even in our wildest dreams back in Hong Kong. I think there's all kinds of hopes for reform, not just from the U.S. government, but from other countries banding together, from tech companies pressuring the government, from citizens, individuals, protecting their communications with encryption and the like. I think there'll be lots of changes over time.
Well, Glenn Greenwald is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His new book is No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. He's going to be joining Noam Chomsky for a discussion tonight on these issues at the First Parish Church in Cambridge. Glenn Greenwald, what a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
It was really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, there's more of the show coming up in just a moment, so stick with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.